Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks to Kansas State Representative Christy Williams of House District 77, chair of the K-12 Education Budget Committee. A former teacher, Rep. Williams discusses the education choice landscape in the Jayhawk State and the last legislative session, where an existing tax credit scholarship was expanded to make more families eligible, but a proposal for a landmark education savings account ultimately failed to become law. What is the future of education choice in Kansas? That question and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the episode.
So today I'm excited to have Representative Christy Williams of Kansas. She's a Republican representing District 77. Representative Williams is the chair of the K-12 Education Budget Committee, has been in the Kansas legislature since 2015, and I think is also a former educator. So welcome, Representative Williams.
Thank you.
So let's start a little bit with the background in Kansas. What are the various choice programs you have now? And then we'll talk about your very exciting legislative session this spring. So what are some examples of education choice options available today for families in Kansas?
Kansas, though very conservative state, is one of the most restrictive states in terms of school choice. The only choice option we have is the tax credit for low-income students. And thankfully, this year, we were able to expand that to include a free and reduced lunch of students between K and eighth grade. Prior to that, it was so restrictive that it was free lunch only, and it would have been the 100 lowest performing elementary schools. So it was a big win for Kansas.
So I know you have some charter schools. You have a handful of charter schools. I presume you have some kind of virtual school statewide?
Yes, we do have that. Uh-huh.
And you probably have some within district choice. You have any magnet schools or anything like that?
In larger districts, we do have some magnet schools.
With a state like Kansas, the stereotype is that it would be a very robust state for education choice outside of school districts. Why has it been so difficult to get an expansion of education choice in Kansas?
Well, I would say there's a couple reasons. One reason is because if you're a rural Kansas, we're a state of just under 3 million people. But if you live in a rural community, then maybe your largest employer is your school district. And so your superintendents, your principals, your teachers, they're your friends. They go to your church. You see them in the grocery store. And they very much oppose it because, honestly, of the fear of the unknown. They also oppose it because organizations such as the Kansas Association of School Boards or the Kansas Association of Superintendents or the NEA, any type of union group, they present it as doom and gloom that we're taking money from public schools and we are giving it to private schools rather than thinking of it more accurately as we're allowing that money to follow the students. Students going to be educated, and we want them to be educated in the environment that will bring them the most success.
Let's talk a little bit about this legislative session. I've read a lot about what you guys did, and you talked about the success you had. But it was a complex process, as they always are. The sausage-making process was complex, yeah. In Kansas as every place else. So why don't we talk a little bit about what you were trying to do? I mean, you had two bills. You had 2119 in the House, and you had 2068. Talk about those two bills that you filed, what you initially were trying to accomplish.
Okay, great. Great question. And it is such a long process, and but we never really lost faith in what we were going to accomplish. We knew we would have to pare down some of our greater, loftier goals, but it was all part of the bargaining process. So it worked out very well. So in Kansas, like the rest of the United States, we were faced with many school districts, especially large school districts that were closed. And in fact, we had one school district in Kansas City and one in Topeka, Kansas that remained without any hybrid or any in-person learning option until April of 2021. So for Kansas, that just seemed extreme. We just didn't have any deaths with children. We had a very low sickness rate, very low hospitalization rate, and so it didn't make sense. So parents were upset, and they were trying to share their grievances with their school boards, but unsuccessfully. They were blocked out in many cases. And so that was one of the things that initiated, you know what, this is the right time for a big school choice bill. So we put it together prior to our session. Our session starts in January, and we included ESAs, expansion of tax credits. And to hit real quick on the ESA, what we did initially was we said if your school was closed and you only had a remote or hybrid option, then you could opt for choice. That means you could go somewhere else if that would better meet your needs. And then we also focused on low-income kids and kids that were failing in the public schools. So what happened next is we had in our committee many different roundtable sessions on the remote learning. We had parents come in, we had doctors come in, we had kids that came in or zoomed in and shared with us their experiences. So over a course of time and a different piece of legislation that required schools to go back to school by, I think it was April 3rd, then that took that off the table. And we decided to move into grace mode for that and eliminate that from our ESA bill. As all your legislators know, that you start off with your grand ideal bill, and then you pare it down to what do I need to do to get consensus. And in Kansas, in the House, that's 63 votes to pass. And so we took the remote off. We took off low income as well for the educational savings account. And the reason is the tax credit was entirely income-based. So we made that our focus, that the tax credit would be entirely income-based for free and reduced lunch students. And then we would make ESA for those students that were failing in the system. That means that maybe they had high absenteeism rates, suspension rates, they weren't reading or testing at their grade level. So we use those markers that school districts mark for at-risk funding, and we tied it. And dyslexia was part of that as well. So that was what initially passed the House by, I believe, 65 votes. It included the expanded tax credits. It included the ESA. And in Kansas, the hook, line, and sinker is the money. And typically, we put the $6 billion that we spend in education funding, and we put it with our mega bill, which funds everything in our state general fund and beyond. And that's just not a good idea for education, because we have a Kansas Supreme Court that ruled that we have to spend a certain amount of money and we have to inflate it every year. And we have to have a certain amount of state-based aid. So essentially, our Kansas Supreme Court ignored our Kansas Constitution that gives the legislative body the power of the purse and dictated 52% of our budget. And yes, and because of that, and until we have a Republican governor and a legislative body that wants to take that constitutional challenge on, or until we can come up with a new constitutional amendment that relates to school funding that disallows them to do that, our hands are tied. And so from my perspective as a chair, it's been my goal. Okay. My goal has been, all right, so we have to comply with $6 billion with inflation, increased spending, which is approximately between 180 to 280 million more every year. If that's the case, you're going to have more accountability. You're going to have some choice. You're going to have provisions that you didn't have before. And honestly, in Kansas, it has been difficult to pass education reform without tying it to the money. And that's how we won, was tying it to money.
So the compromise bill strengthened the tax credit program for K-8, but excluded high school. What was the what was the need to compromise there? What was the pushback against including high school?
So initially, remember, it was only the lowest 100 elementary schools. So by just taking it up to K-8, you are reaching the majority of students that you're trying to reach before it's almost too late. I would love to have it open to all the high schoolers, but that was a negotiation we made with our Democratic governor. Initially, they told us that she would not sign anything that included reduced lunch, and she only wanted to go up to sixth grade. But we were able to, we were able to get it to the next level, and she was willing to sign it. And I'll tell you what made that more possible. Most states would say, well, that's not a big deal. Tax credits, why would that be so difficult? The Democrats hate any choice in Kansas, and they put the fear of God in many less conservative Republicans and rural Republicans. So it's been almost impossible to get through. What made it possible? The dreaded, what they call the Frankenstein bill, which was the educational savings account that would take our base state aid, which is approximately $4,696 or somewhere in that amount, that those kids could use for all kinds of choice options. By us agreeing to remove the ESA, whoa, all of a sudden tax credits look like a flower, that they could easily take and live with. And so that's how it survived.
So that sounds like it was more sort of political posturing back and forth and political negotiations versus any kind of deep analytical reason why, you wouldn't include high schools or why you would include eighth grade versus sixth grade. I mean, I presume the governor's getting a lot of pressure from her core constituency, her political base. And so she's trying to figure out how far can I go before alienating my base. I also have to work with a Republican legislature. So that's pretty much what's going on.
Absolutely. That is what's going on. Also, we have a cap of $10 million. So we have never reached that cap before. We have only gone, I think $3.5 million, somewhere around that. So we had plenty of room for the next several years until we have a Republican governor just by restricting it. It gives her a win. It gives us a win. But honestly, it gives us a bigger win than it does for her. And the other thing I have to remind your listeners is I don't think that she would have even negotiated that had there not been the money, because we did not have any money funded for education until veto session, which is really rare for you to push it off. But because it failed in the Senate right before veto session, we just let it sit.
Did the flood of federal money have any impact? I mean, a lot of states... it's been raining money from the federal government. How did that impact the process?
So for us, Kansas received I want to say $1.3 billion from the federal government and in total funding. And some of our largest districts, for example, the Wichita School District is the largest in Kansas, bigger than our Johnson County School Districts, and they received $250 million. Now, of course, that's based on Title I. In our bill that we passed, we only dictated or asked or directed the Kansas Department of Education and our state school board to use $10 million of those dollars to things such as Safe and Secures, which is protects our school buildings, as well as a mental health programs and a community in schools. They declined to follow our directive. And so the state board, after we passed our legislation, said, no, thank you. We're not going to do that. So $10 million out of $1.3 billion, they deny the legislature the directive, which is really kind of silly. Why would you bite the hand that feeds you with your general fund? It just doesn't make sense to me that they would want to pick that fight. So in terms of the bill, it didn't have a huge impact because we left it alone. We just left it alone, except in terms of discussions.
Talk to me about why there's so much hostility towards the education savings account. As you know, it seems to be an increasingly popular concept around the country. I think there was 10 or 12 legislatures this year that had strong ESA bills, four or five passed. You see it happening around the country, mainly because it allows families to access services beyond the school day. And I know you have four kids, and I suspect if I followed your kids around, I'd find a tremendous amount of learning and development activities going on after school in the summer. I'm sure there's all kinds of things going on. And low-income families don't have those opportunities. You know, they can't afford necessarily sports or theater or all the things that middle-class and upper-middle-class families provide for their kids. So there's a growing movement around ESAs to help families have more flexibility. Talk to me about the pushback in Kansas. Why were people so terrified of ESAs?
Well, they're not educated on ESAs. They're not familiar with ESAs. Their school districts receive information constantly about how they are bad. And so when that is where you're getting your source of information, then it's just hard to overcome that.
Yeah.
So it's our job to re-educate and to make sure we emphasize over and over again that it's about the kids. The kids are first. The kids are priority. If they're not succeeding in school, should we let them just stay there? Because in Kansas right now, if you are a free and reduced lunch student, 11% are not proficient. Only 11% are proficient in math, and only 16% are proficient in ELA, which is English Language Arts. Wow. So to me, that's not good enough. And so we have been pushing that to show people to open their eyes about how kids are actually doing. And the pushback we get from the State Board of Education, as well as the Kansas Department of Education, is, oh, the tests, they're not, you know, that doesn't tell the whole picture. And I would agree, it doesn't tell the whole picture, but it is one piece of quantitative data that we need. And they write those tests, they set those standards. So if they're saying that they don't matter, then I would question what they're doing.
Right. And of course, parents are in a really good position to know how their kids are doing too. But if you deny them choice, then they can't act on what they're seeing. So.
And yeah, here's another reason choice is so important. And it's not only about making sure kids have an in-person opportunity to be educated. It's not only about the flexibility that it provides some students with during the day or the types of coursework that they might be able to take online that they couldn't receive in a rural community. But it's also about different types of teaching that's hitting our public schools that some parents do not want. If you do not believe that critical race theory is consistent with your religious beliefs or your political beliefs, then you have nothing that you can really do except exit the public school. So I think that there are political and religious reasons that parents are opting out of the public schools as well. And it's too bad, because I'll tell you right now, my school district, which is 10 miles east of Wichita, so we're part of a suburb, it's losing enrollment. And I think it's losing enrollment in part because people are choosing other things and they're paying for it, whether it's homeschool or private school.
Yeah. And the tough thing about that is it really exacerbates inequalities, because that means people who can't afford those options don't get a chance to raise their children either in the religious tradition that they'd like to, at least in a school context, or any other kind of values that they care about. I agree with you. I think our democracy is strengthened when families have the option, the freedom to match their children with the learning environment that best meets their needs as relates to not just academics, but also character and values and faith, et cetera. So hopefully you'll get there someday.
Actually, we have plans, and I do believe that the ESAs, they will be back when we have a Republican governor. I think that they will be back. And I also add to that list of concerns for parents, it hasn't happened yet in Kansas that I'm aware, but we've heard of it in California, New York, and elsewhere, where Virginia, where state boards and departments of education are eliminating higher level math classes so that they can create a more equity-based environment where everybody has the same outcomes. And I think that is not going to work for many parents. And I would certainly think that that's not good for America. We should be advancing our students as far as they possibly can.
So let's talk about the future. You mentioned, without revealing too much, and I don't want to get you in trouble or anything, but what are you thinking about next session? I mean, what do you, have you started to think about what you're going to try to do next?
Yes. So we have a great group in my committee, as well as individuals in the Senate that are very pro-education. And so we pick these topics and think about them earnestly. We are going to be looking at this year in Kansas. This is our thought, is just the accountability aspect. How did our kids perform when they were remote? How are the state standardized test scores in comparison? How are our local school districts and school boards doing in terms of making choices for their curriculums and spending? That's next session. We are going to put 1 year planning regarding accreditation and choice kind of on hold with research behind it. And then we plan, if all goes well, to go full throttle on choice.